Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Tim O'Brien, best known over the past decades as the author of The Things They Carried, a book that changed my outlook on a lot of things, just as it did for one of the characters in this memoir, or pretty modest-level memoir. Tim started off back in the 70s with If I Die in a Combat Zone, Box Me Up and Ship Me Home. He won the National Book Award thereafter for Northern Lights and Going After Cacciato. His other works include, in part, The Lake of the Woods, Tomcat in Love, and July, July. And as you'll see in this book, his influences include Hemingway, Conrad, Faulkner. His collision with truth has run through his novels, if they're all novels, except perhaps with my favorite of his, The Nuclear Age. So thanks, Tim, for joining us today.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, so, you know, so I said it. So what is the truth anyway?
Well, it's a complicated question. I can answer it by way of anecdote best. That I found myself 50 years ago in a war, getting shot at and watching people die, both Vietnamese and American. And after 2 or 3 months of this, you began to wonder if what's happening around you is really happening or not. Is it true? You lose in a war your sense of the definite, but you lose a sense even of yourself. Who am I? I had thought that the truth was that I was a peace-loving, nice guy from the farm country of southern Minnesota. And I found myself pulling the trigger and trying to kill people in a war that I really despised. So what was the truth about even myself? I didn't know. And I think that in times of trauma, it doesn't have to be a war. It could be your mom and dad have gotten divorced, or you've come down with some dread disease, and you're lying in a hospital, don't know if you'll make it. And you lose that sort of commonsensical, everyday notion of what's true. Your mind wanders, and it may be true you're in a hospital bed, but you're also a six-year-old kid playing catch with your father out on the lawn in the house you grew up in. There's a sense of dreaminess for me about the life I've led, and the older I get, the more indefinite and ambiguous and less concrete everything becomes. So the truth for me ultimately comes down to, does a thing feel true? It may be a daydream, but it's a true great daydream. Nobody ever had a fake one. It's a real daydream. And those daydreams are as important to us. They determine much of our lives. We sort of try to step into our own dreams, even though they aren't real in the sense of the everyday world. So if you dream of being a doctor, you may go to medical school, and if you dream of being president of the United States, you might take steps in college and afterward to move in that direction. So I think that the last thing I can say about it is that truth with a capital T can kill people. That when it's enunciated with a kind of absolutist, no doubt, for sure, confidence about the world we live in, that verges on a kind of zealous truth, knowing what cannot be known. And so people who, you know, put an absolutist spin on things they declare to be true, they bother me. It used to be true back during the colonial era that witches of Salem were were causing people to get sick and people to die, and that was believed was the kind of absolutist rhetoric. They were hanged and killed. And I thought, I mean, Hitler thought he had the corner on the truth, and plenty of other people throughout the history of our world. The world was once considered flat. It's not. And what was once true no longer is. What about love? One day we may be madly in love when you're 16 years old with a high school cheerleader. And a week later, you're in love with somebody else. And that happens all the way through life. People do get divorced, and love does come to an end. And what was true on Thursday may not be true on Sunday, or a week later, or a month later, or a year later. So the question's a complicated one, and it's what I try to talk to my kids about in this book, that watch out for the word truth. It can be a dangerous word.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, we're talking about Dad's Maybe book, actually published today, by Houghton Mifflin and Harcourt, and the beginning of the book, which was actually titled by your kids, Timmy and Tad, and so in the beginning, it's really interesting because, you know, in all your books, the truth is kind of not amorphous, but basically what you just said. And so, but in the beginning of this book, it's like as true as you can get because it's about this absolute love, this unconditional love. So it's really, really true. But then the book starts to morph like you have, almost like you can't help it, and it morphs into this. For example, when you say that your son's first words were, "'Tis a tale told by an idiot." I mean, and you go into it. I mean, the question is, it's not true, but if you say it, like if I say, you and I have, or my son and you have the same birthday. I know you're born October 1st. My son is actually born on October 3rd. But if I say to you in this interview, you have the same birthday as my son, it's true if I tell you that and if everyone listening hears that. And but why did you, in this case, and also inventing a daughter, why do you do that? And what do you get out of it?
It's a way of exploring truths that aren't literal, that are instead emotional, that all of us as parents, when we hear the first utterances of our kids, it feels like a kind of miracle has occurred. It seems impossible that magic has happened when the first words come out of a child's mouth, no matter what the words may be, dada or mommy or whatever the word is. It feels emotionally miraculous. And so what I tried to do with the little anecdote that you mentioned, I was giving a talk one point to a group of aspiring writers at a writer's conference called Swanee. And I wanted to make them feel this miraculous sensation I had when my son, my older son, uttered his first words. At about a year or so old. And so I made up words. 'Tis a tale told by an idiot. Idiot. There are the words from Shakespeare, of course. But I said those were the first words. And it was immediately people, of course, they didn't believe me literally. They laughed, as I hoped they would. And then the little joke went on for a while. And then I moved to what I thought was important to all of us, is the life is full of little miracles like that. And the goal of a writer is to make the miracle seem to happen right before the eyes of a reader as a book is being read. A sense of disbelief, and then a sense of, well, maybe it could have happened. So the object is to get at what I call emotional truth. There are certain things that don't happen in the literal, real world, but are quite moving to us as human beings. My dad died, for example, 10 years ago. And I had failed to go down 40 miles to a hospital where he lay dying. I didn't know he was dying, but he was. Well, ever since that death of my dad, I'll go over it in my imagination. I'll imagine getting in my car and driving those 40 miles and going into that hospital room. And I'll imagine my dad sitting up from the dead and just saying, "I know you love me. You didn't have to make that drive. I know it." Well, that can't happen. The dead can't sit up and talk. But that little anecdote, even though it didn't happen and even though it couldn't happen, moves me in a way that the truth doesn't. It makes me tear up when I imagine my father sitting up and saying, "I know you love me."
That's so interesting the way you... I wonder how many... If we all do that and you just... Yeah, well, here's a way of asking it. So throughout your life, who has been the man in the straw boater? It's almost like he's a Jungian archetype for you. Because there's always somebody who says, "You're lying. Don't make fun of us. You know, how can you expect us to believe this?" So that through in your literature and in your life, especially when you talk like this to people, is there always a man in a straw boater who's there? Is he in your mind as well?
I guess the man in the straw boater is really directed at all the literalists in the world. Those who, well, I don't know what really happened, even in the midst of a novel that's entirely invented, students will ask me, teachers will ask me, book clubs will ask me, what really happened? And there's a demand for literalism that I find very strange. That when I go into a movie theater, I don't sit watching a movie thinking, "That didn't happen. That's not real. That's not real. That didn't happen."
Right.
At some point, you surrender to a story, and you don't demand the literal. And it's that's the man in the straw boater for me. It comes in all kinds of sizes and shapes and ages, but there is a literalist strain among certain people that require a kind of absolute knowledge. For me, the questions that are most important don't have literal answers. Where do we go after we die? Will I cry, or will I scream, or will I, when the day comes when I'm going to die? We don't know. What were Custer's last thoughts at the Little Bighorn? We don't know. He died. I'm sure he had thoughts, but we don't know. Did Lizzie Borden take an axe and give her mother 40 whacks? We don't know. She was found innocent, and there's no literal answer to it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I'm getting at when I poke fun at the man in the straw boater.
Yeah, it really is a very interesting way of looking at it. You know, well, you know, a perfect example is in terms of suspension of disbelief is in every movie, whether it's The Magnificent Seven or the gunfight at the O.K. Corral, you forget that those guns only had 6 bullets and they're firing like 50 of them. But it's fine, you know. It's just fine. And the other thing is, you
that's
know,
a great example. A literalist could say, "Yeah, but a revolver only holds, you know, 6 bullets. That's impossible." And the person who's not a literalist sit beside him and will think, "Yeah, but the effect was amazing. It felt cool."
Yeah, and that's true whether you're watching Matt Damon and The Bourne Supremacy or whatever. It's always true, and we always totally disregard it, unless we're in real life. And that's kind of, again, if you're in real life, and going back, and I know this is something that everyone talks to you about, you know. In the things they carried, everybody wants to know, well, did this part actually happen to you? Did this part actually happen to you? Did you invent this guy, or is he real? And that must have happened to you hundreds, if not thousands of times in the past more than quarter of a century, right?
Quite, yeah. I'd say more than 1,000. It happens every other day. The answer is complex. Literally, the events and the things they carried, most of the events did not happened to me the way they're described in the book. they were launched out of the stories and were launched out of real experience. I really was a foot soldier in Vietnam. I really went through a nightmare of death and horror, and terror, sadness. All that's real. And some of the anecdotes begin with an actual event that I witnessed. But they all swiftly move into the realm of make-believe. I invent things that didn't happen, but that could have happened. And maybe in some cases should have happened. I wrote a whole novel called Going After Cacciato, in which a soldier says, in Vietnam, says to himself, I'm out of here. I'm leaving this war. This is immoral and hateful, and I'm out. I'm walking to Paris. Well, I didn't, and the rest of the novel is a man walking away from a war. Well, I didn't do it, literally, but it was launched out of my desire to be out of this nightmare of endless, repetitive, day-by-day grinding horror. Even when bad things weren't happening, there was the feel that they were about to happen, and they did. And there was this desire to leave. And that's a human, I think that's true of almost all soldiers. There are very few killer sadists that I saw in the war. And there was a longing, even among the most macho guys, to go home and find their sweetheart and go drink a cold Coca-Cola and have a Big Mac, all the things we didn't have. There was a longing for peace to be out of it. And so that's a great example, I think, of what I mean by you begin in the human heart, your desires and yearnings, your grief, and you move into another world of maybe this and maybe that.
Yeah. It's funny. You answered a question that I ask many of the authors that I interview, and maybe that's why I can't write, because I can't get this through my head. But what you say is you're allowed to lie. You can lie about everything. And
not only that, we're paid to lie. I mean, that's what a novel is. It's made up. And then the goal for a writer, I'm sure all the writers you've talked to, the goal is to make it feel as if it's unfolding before a reader's eyes, even though on the front page of almost all novels, it'll be a little, or not the front page, but the front material, it'll say, you know, these events are, they're wholly invented. They don't correspond to anything in the real world. But then you try to convince the reader through dialogue and through people doing unusual things and behaving, moving through the course of the lives in the novel. You try to convince them that it's happening, and that's the joy of it. It's the moving into this world of maybe-ness, of a world of in a way, you want the reader to think, if I were in that circumstance, if a doctor had just told me, you've got breast cancer, and how would I respond? What would come out of my mouth? How would I feel leaving that doctor's office in the first 5 minutes as you walk to your car, to drive home, to tell your children, your husband?
Yeah.
We live our lives largely in our heads that way. And what's happening in our heads isn't real in the common and sensical sense of the word real, but it's real inside your head. It's happening and unfolding inside your head. And that's the feel I like to try to give a reader in the course of a book.
Well, here's something. So, like I said when we were talking before the beginning of the broadcast, you know, you're 73, I'm 67. So when I was, I guess, 53, we adopted our second child from China. And Annie is now 18, and I'm 67. And until I read your book, not to blame you, I never thought once, not one time, about the fact that I would be 70 when she was 21. I never thought, I won't be able to, she's good at softball. I won't be able to play softball with her because I can't move around. I still play softball. You still play golf, whatever. But the thing about it is, I never really thought about it. I just thought about every day. And I never really thought, you know what it's basically like? And I don't know if you can do this or not, because it's kind of clear in the book. When I look in the mirror, whenever I look in the mirror, I see myself. That's all I see. I don't see this old guy that's going bald and has white hair. You know, I just see me. And so it never crossed my mind that I should think about the fact that I'm not going to be around. So it was kind of, I don't know if it's a revelation or, you know, I don't know what it was. But can you see the way, do you see the way I'm coming at it?
Yeah, no, I see it completely. People are different. When I had my first son, I was 58 or 56, one of the two. So a bit older than you were.
Yeah.
And my dad had recently died, and he never gave me a sense of being even liked, much less loved.
Well, that makes a difference.
And I wanted to give my kids something I never received. My dad was a terrible drunk. The house was full of anger and bitterness. He was committed twice to institutions for alcoholism. I was ashamed and embarrassed in front of my friends as a kid. So I'd gone through a personal experience that made me want to give to my children something that I never got. And it occurred to me when my first son was born that I didn't get words of love, and by God, I was going to give them to my child. Even if I'm dead, I'm going to write them down so that years later they'll be inside a desk drawer, all dusty, just scraps of paper, telling them a little bit about the intensity of my love, leaving maybe a few words of advice here and there about absolutism and the dangers of it, and a few memories of their own lives when they were children, you know, as they began to grow up. And for 15 years, that's what I did. I wrote these little love letters that, like messages in a bottle, for my kids could read when they were 40 or 50 years old. And so it grew out of very special circumstances. I was an older father. Now I'm ancient. I mean, not that ancient isn't the right word, but I'm a lot older than I was when I began writing.
You're not really.
So there's that special circumstance. And then there's my own father. There's that special circumstance. And there's also the circumstance that I'm a writer. Why not write for my kids?
That's true.
So Dad's Maybe book was not written to be a book initially. For the first 10 years, it wasn't. It was written only with the idea of my kids as the audience, no one else. And over time, pieces of paper piled up, and it began to look like it maybe someday could be a book, and I began then trying to shape it as a book. So I understand completely where your question comes from, your own experience, and you never gave it a thought. That how old, you know, your own child would be when you turn 70. But in my case, the circumstances were obviously pretty different.
Here's a mean question I've been thinking of all week, and I hope you won't take it the wrong way. But if you were scared that you wouldn't be able to play basketball or you wouldn't be around for them to play golf with you when they were older, why didn't you quit smoking?
It's the inertia of life, I think, more than anything. I was so busy working on these love letters, and I've been so used to smoking while I'm doing it. I don't smoke quite as much as I might have given the impression in my life about, and I don't smoke around my kids. So when I'm alone, I do do it. But it's a good question, and the answer is human insanity. The sane thing to do would be to stop. And maybe, who knows, maybe someday I will. The odds are looking slim, but maybe so. I better put the one out in my hand right now. You've embarrassed me.
What kind of cigarettes do you smoke?
They're supposed to be light and tart. They're called Carlton's. They have these little holes in the filter that all the smoke is supposed to come out of, so it never goes into your mouth. But all I do is cover up the holes in my mouth and suck it in.
Yeah, they were horrible cigarettes. Just like Tartans are horrible. At least don't make those. So
I should say about smoking, I used to, when I was a kid, I hated it when my dad smoked and my mom. And I vowed I would never do it. It wasn't even a vow. I just assumed I never would. And then Vietnam came along.
Oh, yeah. And everybody
in our sea rations, the government, in collusion with the tobacco companies, was giving a generation of young soldiers, the people fighting for the country, they were hooking them in your sea rations. And then if that weren't enough, they would also, by helicopter, fly out big boxes filled with cartons of cigarettes to disperse to the troops, like a little care package. So by the time I came home after, you know, a year of just smoking and combat, I was as hooked as a person could get. I thought I was going to die anyway, so I began smoking in Vietnam. And it was, it's followed me my entire life.
You know, it's really interesting. Like, when you're in prison, you smoke a lot. When you're in war, you smoke a lot. When you're depressed, you smoke a lot. And it's like they become your friends. And for a moment, or 7 minutes, you're comforted. And I remember when I was depressed and I would sit against this brick wall. And
or even you smoke when you're doing a podcast interview. It's stressful.
Well, so let's go back to the book, because we're trying to sell a book. When the book really did morph a couple of ways, because in the center section, which I really enjoyed a lot, we're talking about Hemingway, and then at the end, which we'll get to, you switch to what I'm thinking now about how basically we are the killers, and when we are the beheaders, and no one really, well, maybe some people realize it now, I don't know. But so in the middle, when you talk about Hemingway, and you talk about a clean, well-lighted space, the killers, Cat in the Rain, the three-day blow, and then the fact that you gave the killers to your kids to read, they didn't have the same visceral response that you had, but I did when I read it, even though, like you said, it's kind of unbelievable. Well, there you go, the truth. But, yeah, so there's something, it seems like, with you, and especially with his short stories, although you do bring up Farewell to Arms, too. And his short story, like a very short story, they are very short, but there's something about them that draws you to them very tightly. What is that?
It's emotional unity, emotional impact. His stories are so tightly knit that they leave you with a strong, visceral, visual memory in your blood of what the story is about. A very short story is one page long. I had my kids read it. And it's the story of a guy's failed love in war, and he ends up catching gonorrhea back home in the back of a taxi cab. Love has died in this ugly end, and I gave it to both children to read when they were 11, 12. And I said to the older kid, he was 11 then, I said, well, how did you like it? And he said, well, I said, it was embarrassing.
Maybe you
I
shouldn't.
Said, well, it was embarrassing. And he says, embarrassing when your dad tells you to read about sex diseases. And, you know, it hadn't occurred to me that would be the response. I thought he'd be reading about failed love, you know, it had died and this tragic end to it. But no, he just felt a blush because his dad had given him a story to read.
Your kids are hilarious. All the anecdotes you tell about them are so
They come
fun.
Up with that line.
I know.
One, the younger kid, his name's Tad. who's now 14, but at the time he was 7. I'd been moaning to my wife about some TV interview. Somebody wanted us to go kill more people in a war. And I was saying, oh, God, my books are worthless. That the only book that'll work is one that'll shoot off your nose as you're reading it, and your lips, and your ears. And Tad heard me saying this, and he said, I guess you shouldn't hold that book in your lap. And he, I would kill for lines like that as a writer. They just don't occur to me. I have to work for them. But there's something about the sensibility of a kid somewhere between the ages of, I don't know, 6 and 12, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Where they can come up with the most startling and sometimes literary lines that are so resonant and so perfectly formed that they exceed my capabilities to imagine the lines, to imagine the language for myself. I write different kinds of lines. They write lines of genius.
It's funny because I write down things that Annie said, like, when she was like 5 years old, I walked into her room to wake her up, and she says, top of the morning, do you?
She doesn't have much Irish blood, does she?
No, and she's the most, she's just so deadpan when she does it. I was going out with this, my girlfriend, and Annie comes to the door, and the girl says, come on in. And Annie says, that's a little strange since it is our house. And the girl then said, well, thanks for hanging out with me today. And Annie goes, well, I don't mean this in a mean way, but did we really have a choice?
Yeah.
So she's good. And your kids are just the same way.
Well, you've gone through the same experience.
Yeah, she goes, if frankincense was good enough for Jesus.
And along the same lines, one of the most indelible memories of being a father, now for 16 years I've been a father, is a day my mother died. We were vacationing in southern France at this really ritzy, way too expensive hotel. We didn't realize how expensive this place was, but it was, looked like it was filled with movie stars. I mean, everybody was tanned and jewelry. I mean, it looked like they were worth $1 billion each. And I got a phone call out on, we were at an outdoor bar, my wife and I, and it was my sister calling and saying my mother had died. And I walked over to where the kids were playing ping pong on this lawn. It was like it was made out of green velvet. It was just perfectly manicured. And I told the kids my mother had died, and they didn't say much, and I didn't say much either. And for the rest of the afternoon, I played ping pong pretty silently. And as dusk began falling, we walked away from this ritzy resort down this hill into a small town where we could have a cheap meal. And I was holding my older son, Timmy's hand, as we went down the hill in this kind of purple twilight and the beautiful Mediterranean. And I said to him, are you thinking about Grandma? And he said, no, I'm thinking about you thinking about Grandma.
Yep.
And you can hear my voice choke up even now.
Yep.
I can't utter those words without, it's a beautifully phrased, I'm thinking about you thinking about Grandma. It's so beautifully phrased with the two thinkings. But underneath it is, I thought he was emotionally void. He was a kid. He was like 6, 7 years old. And to have that kind of thought where he's empathetic, he's thinking about someone else's pain, and it's one of those miraculous moments where you can't make them happen. They simply explode on you.
I know, and the reason why you tear up, which I do all the time, is because all it really is like the Beatles says, it's just love. And that's what it is. It's just love and nothing else. And
yeah.
That's why I tear up too. So let me ask you a question. Do you think the Cat in the Rain, do you think there's any possibility at all that the cat that the chambermaid, the maid, brings up, do you think, is there any possibility it's the same cat?
There's a possibility, but I tend to think not.
Yeah.
I think it's probably a stand-in for the vanished cat.
Well, the way he says it's a
prior.
Yeah, the way he says it's a big tabby, you know, that's kind of like saying it's not the same cat.
Right.
But I like to think it was. But anyway, you know, and it's funny, you did your short stories, and then for me, the one that really got to me is The Short Happy Life of Francis McCumber.
Oh, what a great story, yeah.
I know. And
just a beautiful story.
And it leaves you with so many different ways of thinking about three different characters. And all in words,
yeah.
All in words of
yeah,
one or
husband,
two.
Husband, a wife, and the big game hunter. I mean, it's a heartbreaking story too, because I'm not sure his life was short. I'm not sure how happy it was.
Well, he had 30 seconds of it at least. That was perfect. And the thing about it is too is that, you know, Hemingway does this, especially like in The Old Man and the Sea, with words of one or two, max three syllables. You know. And that's another reason why we both love him, I think.
Yeah. It's amazing how he's gotten this kind of ho-hum.
Yeah.
Macho rap, you know, among modern history. When he wrote many, maybe not all of his short stories, but those stories are as close to perfect, I think, as a story can be. He was a sensitive writer and a writer alert to the human heart in a way that was the opposite, I thought, and still think, what we think of as macho.
Yeah. What's the name of the story where the two waiters, after it closes, and they
a clean, well-lighted place, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's... Oh, the other story with the two waiters is the one where they strap the kitchen knives to the chair, and he pretends like he's a bullfighter, and then he gets scored and dies. Remember that one? I forgot what it's called. That was another one. There's so much packed into so few words. It's just unbelievable. And you know,
he's got this ability to compress, which carries a powerful emotional punch to it.
Well, you know, owning an independent bookstore. What I see happening is people go, they'll read books now, and then I say, go back and read this, and they'll go back and read, say, Hemingway, and they'll go, wow, this is nothing special. And I said, that's because everything from it is derivative. You know, they're standing on the shoulders of somebody, but they're kids, and they don't know.
Yeah.
You know, they don't know that this is where it came from. Well, so anyway, I guess to close this out, because I've really enjoyed it, but we're, you know, coming up on 45 minutes. So, you know, you talk in the book about, you know, the hiatus between your works, and has this last book, the maybe book, has it changed your mind? Are you back? Like, are you ready to go to battle once more?
No, I'm ready to get into the hammock with some lemonade and radio, listening to a baseball game.
No, you need to.
I was serious in the book when I said it's always been a struggle from the time I started as a young man till over 50 years. Making sentences is that are fresh enough and feel that they weren't copped out of the latest bit of, you know, last bestseller you read, or that's hard work, and it's hard because of I aspire to a conversational kind of Midwestern diction, and I don't want to be more than I am as a writer, but I want to be the best me that I can be, the best Tim O'Brien there can be. And that is I'm awfully hard on myself. I'll struggle over, should that be that adjective or that one or none at all? And I'll go back and forth trying different versions. My idea of hell is not fire and brimstone. It's sitting in a room in your underwear trying for eternity to write a good sentence. and you do one, finally that's good, and then you got another one. It just never ends. And that's been my life, and I can't say it's been enjoyable exactly. It's been challenging, and it's been satisfying, but it's been, I feel like I've lost a lot that I probably should have had more friends. I don't have many. More leaving the house. I don't leave it often, sometimes for weeks on end.
But
so if there's going to be a capstone to my career, it's going to be this Dad's Maybe book. It has the feel of finality to it. I die at the end, even though I'm not yet dead.
You're going to live a long time. You should stop doing this. You're probably, my mother just died. Yeah. She was 96, and she was happy as a clam. You're probably going to live.
The same guy who was bitching at me for being a smoker, remember? That was only a half hour ago.
Yeah, it's true. Sorry, I forgot. Well, here. It's really selfish of me. But
well, I hope so, but you know, I'm not going to count on it. Well, should any of us?
Well,
it's nothing morbid about it. It's in
no,
way, it's joyful.
No.
It's how the universe is. It was made that way. There are no exceptions. It's going to happen to all of us. And so what a way to go, to say, all right, I'll be gone, but I'm going to leave some words for my children that they'll have their dad in a way, not the body, not that, but they'll have words of love. And don't we all want that?
Yeah, but the thing is, I'm selfish, and it's kind of mean of me again to say, but I want you to live a long time, and I want you to go through through hell so I can read another book by you. So, sorry, but that's the way it is. All right, so anyway, so we've been talking to Tim O'Brien, author of his maybe not, it's Dad's maybe book, but maybe not his last book, if I have anything to do with it. But Tim, thank you so much for being here. I really enjoyed talking.
It was great talking with you. Thanks.
Okay, see ya. Hey, so we've been talking with Tim O'Brien, who's kind of gotten me depressed because I've never thought about, like, my kids are going to be young when I die. You know, I just, like I said, I look in the mirror, I see myself do this thing day by day, and, you know, whatever I last is what I last. My mom just died. She's 96. She never suffered a day of discomfort or pain. She was happy till the end. She sang every day. She laughed every day. And, and she laughed at death. And I think that's important. Get death off. Ooh. So, we have some really good people. Adrienne Brodeur, she's going to talk about her, I guess it's another memoir, but it's been highly anticipated. It's called Wild Game, My Mother, Her Lover, and Me. And, you know, I thought it was like a chick book, and because it has a picture of a girl on the cover and all that. But it was really, really good and not at all what I expected. And then one I just finished, and I'll be talking to her soon, is her name is Catherine Chung. Really smart, smart person. And it's called The Tenth Muse, which deals with, in part, the 23 insolvable mathematical problems posed by David Hilbert about a century ago, and a specific one called the Riemann hypothesis, which deals with non-trivial zeros and an attempt to coordinate a solution to the problem of prime numbers. And even though I'm not a mathematician, I love math and I love intuiting things. And so this book was fascinating because it mixed math with personal relationships, and it was kind of a mystery thriller in a way. So anyway, yeah, this is great. I really have enjoyed this past, I don't know, three quarters of a year talking to all these people, and I can't thank Rebecca enough for getting such great. I mean, I just interviewed Tim O'Brien, the guy who wrote The Things They Carried. I mean, that's pretty special. So anyway, thanks for being here with me to listen to these special people. And I hope you'll be back with us next week for another edition of The Avid Reader.